I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. This is the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm Howard Jacobson of plantyourself.com and the Big Change Program with Josh Lajani. This podcast is part of my mission to help you live a cheerful and celebratory life. Just a quick reminder before we get started, you can still download the No Recipe Required Cheat Sheet, which is just a list, 2 pages of like meals you can make without needing cookbooks or recipes. Healthy, easy to make from ingredients you probably have at home, and you don't have to fuss about it. If those 2 pages would be helpful for you, you can grab them at plantyourself.com/cheat, all lowercase, C-H-E-A-T. And now to today's podcast. My guest is Lee Slonimski. I was introduced to him by our mutual friend Gene Stone, who is an accomplished author, both of many of his own books and also as a collaborator with people like Dr. Michael Greger, Rip Esselstyn, and others. Gene has been very generous with me, hooking me up with people to have on the podcast, and today's guest, Lee Slonimski, is one of these people. Lee is a longtime practitioner of the dark art of managing a hedge fund, and unlike a lot of people in the hedge fund business, Lee is public about what goes on, he's straightforward, and he has a very, very powerful ethical agenda. He's not in this just to enrich himself and his clients, but to use the power of these hedge funds to change the world. And it turns out these hedge funds have an awful lot of power, and most of it is dark and secret. And it was amazing to hear some of the stories and to hear about the structure of this, what has become the largest financial arm of the American and the global economy, even though it's completely separate from the stock market, where you and I can just take a few bucks and go invest. If you want to be in hedge funds, you need a lot of money, you need to know people, you need certain documents, you need access, and this is the money that controls our politics and controls our world. And Lee is an expert at how to use that money as leverage to change the world. For example, we talked about for animal rights and ending how to use hedge funds to end factory farming. He co-founded a hedge fund that is the only majority-owned hedge fund by Native Americans in the country. So we talk a lot about the inner workings of finance, and since I consider myself to be something of a financial simpleton, I ask a lot of questions that I hope will help you as well to begin to decode and understand this world. We also get into the power of being an investor, even in publicly traded companies, and why being an investor and who to email within the company if you're concerned about some of their ethical practices, how you can do that and might be much more effective than if you're just a consumer. And finally, Lee is also an accomplished poet, like top class, not just like he writes a couple of poems every month in his spare time. He has several books of published poetry. They're highly regarded. And when I pushed on whether he's a Renaissance man, Lee assures me he's not. He's simply got two very, very different interests, finance and poetry. But he's a fascinating guy. He's got lots of tales from the trenches, and I think his advice can help all of us be more effective in our own advocacy and activism in this world. So without further ado, Lee Slaninski, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here, and thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, we met through a mutual friend, Gene Stone, who's a prolific author, including a plant-based author and a past guest on this podcast. And he kind of warned me that you have an incredible story with lots and lots of different parts and pieces to it. So let's begin just with kind of, you know, your background, the elevator speech of where you come from and how you got to where you are now.
Right. Well, I have strands running through my life that I'd say go back to the 1960s when I was when I was in junior high school, et cetera. And there's a kind of one of my parents, my father, had worked on Wall Street and was no longer working there when I was growing up, but it certainly started a fascination with it. He had gotten his first job straight out of high school in August of 1929, which was really interesting timing in terms of the October crash. So he had a lot of, I was exposed to a lot of stock market lore. L-O-R-E, and my mother was very literary, and so I had sort of twin interests in business and writing from a very young age, and my mother kind of brought it together for me, I think, around 1967, when she said, you know, there is a well-known poet who's also a businessman, and that turned out to have been Wallace Stevens, who's a poet I much admire and had a pretty big influence on me, and so that kind of fast forwards to 2017, if you want to go that fast, where 2 years ago, I've been running a sort of non-socially conscious hedge fund called Ocean Partners LP since 1999. And 2 years ago, we created what's called a side pocket, which is a part of the fund legally, but focuses on issues related to humane treatment of animals and specifically opposes factory farming or, in fact, opposes the killing of animals for any reason other than self-defense. And, you know, that's now going into its third year. And I continue to have the good fortune to publish books of poems with my publisher, Spite and Dival Press, which is located in Brooklyn, New York. And I have another one now. Called Lion, Gnat, G-N-A-T, coming out sometime in the second half of this year. So I left out a lot of details in between, but I have to say that kind of explains why I'm a stock trading poet.
There's a lot to unpack in there. So let's start with the humane treatment of animals. So when did you get interested in animal welfare in the first place?
So actually, when I was 10 years old and spending the summer in upstate New York in Delaware County, I was bitten by an insect that's never been identified, but maybe a wasp, maybe a spider, and I had an allergic reaction and, you know, a badly swollen head and had to be hospitalized and all that. And actually, initially, I became very angry at the animal world from that incident, but within that same year, which I believe was my first year at junior high school, I started, you know, thinking more about how animals were treated. It just sort of brought the subject to me, and I pretty quickly reached the conclusion that animals were actually treated really badly, and had an idea for a novel, which unfortunately I've never written, called The Animal's Revolt. And so then when I moved on to my college years, I had a romantic relationship with a person who was a vegetarian and almost a vegan. So those, I'd say, were my two sort of youthful influences. And although I stopped eating red meat and poultry in my teens, I have to confess that, I ate fish for a really long time, which, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed about now and regret, but, you know, I was never a complete vegetarian, let alone vegan, until about 15 years ago. And I just, you know, as I continued to think about it and also get more involved with it as it became a political issue in a more prominent way than it had been, say, in the 70s or 80s, then I made that final step.
Well, it sounds like when you first began the journey, you were kind of alone. There wasn't really a social consciousness around this, except in a very, you know, small hippie enclave.
Right. Yeah, I didn't come from any. In the early 70s, in terms of college campuses, there were, I think, the beginnings of kind of a vegetarian/vegan movement. I mean, I actually one year was president of the student government at City College in New York, and a new vegan startup group came, asking for funding from the Student Senate. And even though I'd had the experiences I just mentioned, and also, was thinking about being a vegan, I couldn't get any support at all for actually funding this group from a fairly progressive, it was an anti-war kind of left-leaning coalition that was running the student government, but it didn't get anywhere with the funding request. But there was, in that time period, more and more groups, I think, appearing, which is still the case now. I just spoke at the end of March before a group called the Ivy Vegan Society, which is the various vegetarian vegan groups at the 8 Ivy League schools, which had their conference this year at Harvard University at the end of March, and that's been growing. I understand there might have been something like 60 people at the first one 4 or 5 years ago, and there were several hundred in Cambridge. So, I think in general, we have a demographic shift in the right direction now.
So you went to a sort of a liberal progressive college. You adopted the identity of someone that's sort of the touchy-feely fringe, I'll say, of, around animal rights and animal welfare. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you were really into finance. Did that feel like a contradiction
tension? Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it just came naturally to me. It was totally from my family environment, not the vegetarianism, because it wasn't really a concern, I think, that either one of my parents had ever had, but definitely these two interests I got strong support from my parents for. And, it's sort of like, I guess, being brought up in a religion, maybe, a religion you have a positive experience with. And in point of fact, one of those two orientations is a religion in America, although I would prefer with the animals, but I don't think the stock market is missing that many aspects of religion in this culture. So, I just fit right naturally into it. And many people, in reading that bio think that maybe I'm some sort of Renaissance man, but actually, I'm very narrow. I mean, these are like the only two interests I've ever had for the most part. But I guess our society, on the other hand, is getting so conformist in some ways, other than on the fringes, that to have more than one interest may startle people, especially if it's, we do have this notion of specialization in careers, which I think is not only very limiting, but also is not the best thing for results, since it gives you, less than a full perspective in terms of whatever decisions you might make. But, for me, it's just been sort of who I am, like speaking English or something.
Now, a lot of the recent stuff I've read about sort of managing money and picking investment strategies seems to suggest that there's a lot more luck than skill. So I'm wondering, like, what qualities, do you have and do you see in people that makes them good at that sort of thing? Is it just sort of the willingness
to do
the research?
Yeah, that's a great point. I don't actually have anything formed to tell you about, what element skill or luck might play in stock picking. I mean, there are people who I respect greatly, like John Bogle, the CEO of Vanguard, who believes that skill in picking stocks doesn't exist. As a layperson, I find that really hard to believe, because skill does seem to exist in any human endeavor. But I want to hasten to point out that it's not what I do. And it's not what most hedge funds do, broadly speaking, because there's a whole world of mutual funds out there where people pick stocks and try to have them go up over a long period of time. And, when the market's going up generally since 1932 or 33, actually. You know, it's pretty easy to look good doing that. There's an expression called bull market genius, which I think goes for a lot of the outcomes with stock picking. We don't look for stocks that are really going up or down. We look for stocks that are in a narrow trading range over many years so that we can buy them low and then sell them a few days later or a few years later when they go up a few points. And those stocks are kind of, there's another stock market expression that explains that strategy, and that is the trend is your friend. So we really look for stocks that have done this, say, 19 of the last 20 years. And roll the dice that they'll do it in the 21st or the 22nd year. And honestly, although in flipping a coin, your chances are the same each time you flip it of heads to tails, it's not really true with the behavior of stocks. You know, they do tend to continue to do what they've been doing. So, and I'll give an even simpler example of that. Let's say your goal is to be a low-risk hedge fund manager. Well, okay, maybe there are people who are better at managing risk than others, but if you want to take half of the money that you've been given to manage and keep it in the bank or under the mattress, you're going to lower your risk by 50%, even if you came in last in the United States on your math SATs. You know, it's a question of psychology, really, in my opinion, more than anything else, as far as managing investments in the stock market, and that is not to be greedy. And we do lower risk by trying to keep a large cash position. And again, there's no real great insight in that other than, you know, with the remaining 50%, you have to try to make money so that the investors do not, you know, lose precipitously. But basically, if half of the money is in the bank, it's not going to be victimized by the stock market crash. So, you know, we try. I mean, I learned all this over many years, and I learned it really initially in the severe bear market of 1973-74, which was the bear market tied to Nixon's impeachment and also to problems with the stability of the U.S. dollar. And inflation, where the stock market went down 80% actually over 2 years. It's the last real bear market we've had. By comparison, the 08, you know, crash recovered relatively quickly. And I learned from that, you know, if you don't own a stock, it can't go down.
So that's, I mean, it seems like a very organic, non sort of chest thumping way to look at it. So if I understand it correctly, you look at these stocks that kind of look like ripples on a pond that are just going up and down within a range, and you know that range over 20 years, and so you buy when the wave is low, and then you sell when the wave is high. It seems like not a very macho way to do it.
Well, how are you describing that? It's very poetic, actually. So, I'm going to remember that the next time I write a poem. Yeah, it's funny. I don't really think of it in terms of macho. This would have been 1966, and I was starting to follow the actual stock market after having lived with my father's stories for quite a few years, which included people jumping off of ledges. And I looked at what was then, I think, the second largest company in the country, which is now ExxonMobil, but was a ticker symbol SO, as in the old SO gas stations, which was Standard Oil of New Jersey. And anyone who's sufficiently interested can look this up. But in that year, it traded between 67 and 72, up and down, up and down. And I watched it for a year. And then I convinced my mother to go down to the Merrill Lynch office in the Time Life building because I couldn't open up an account myself. And I said to the guy, you know, all I really want to do here is buy it at 67 and sell it at 71. And he kind of said to me, well, we'll certainly make commissions that way, so go right ahead. And I did, and I actually made a lot of money in that stock when I was in college, and I continue to do that. Now, you do have to adjust. I mean, I'm giving a very, you know, basic, simple picture here. The range can change. But the idea that, you know, really most of the stock market activity in a given year is typically happens on 5 or 6 days, and all the other trading days the market's going nowhere, is actually quite mathematically accurate. So if you can make money on these, you know, sort of back and forth wave-like movements as you very aesthetically describe them, I mean, you can, you know, over time, you know, really have a very strong performance.
Yeah, and the reason that fascinates me, you know, this is not a podcast about finance, and you know, I never, you know, I never really talk about this stuff with anyone, but it feels like there is something naturalistic about the way you do it, which is kind of at odds with the way I think about at least the culture of Wall Street that's been presented to me through, you know, people I know
right.
from having grown up in North Jersey and from, like, you know, The Big Short and the movies is that there's sort of, you know, it's, to me, it ties in with this idea of animals and your interest in humane treatment, that we're not trying to, like, overcome nature and math, but we're trying to live within it, within its means and our own.
It's a great point. I mean, there are many, many theories, actually, about the stock market that have been written, you know, that various people have come up with. And I'll just mention two of the more outlying ones. There's a theory that the stock market actually is itself a personality and a mind, that it's sort of equivalent to an extraterrestrial organism and may even be an alien intelligence. And that's because, you know, basically the stock market often does things in its performance that seem to be at variance with, you know, what seem to be a more rational approach. And we're living in the middle of one of those examples right now in the so-called Trump market, because it would seem to many people, including many people who work on Wall Street, that they're, I'll put this as nicely as I can, that there would at least be a risk with an inexperienced new president, if you don't want to use stronger language, in terms of instability. And the market hates instability, it hates risk, and it hates war. That's coming as a surprise to some people who might associate, you know, capitalism with arms profit and all that. But the record is that the stock market closed for World War One for 6 months because of the total sort of breakdown in morale. And the stock market had its worst period since the crash of 1929 during the Vietnam War. It hates war. I'm not saying it hates war for moral reasons. It hates war because of the greater uncertainty that war brings in terms of predicting economic performance. So to trade in a straight line up since November 8th, 2016, without taking into account what I would say, you know, was pretty obviously an increased risk of some sort of surprises happening, seems very strange and irrational. In fact, it is. But I don't believe the stock market's rational. I don't believe, I'll rush to add, I don't believe the stock market's an alien organism. I think it's a marketplace where people buy and sell in the same way they do, like in a bazaar in Morocco, only a much larger number of people. And there's no rhyme or reason in gauging the, you know, billions of decisions that go every hour into stocks going up and down. I think in this country, what you're referring to also is that we have very much a, you know, an investor culture, which began really in the 1950s and, you know, famously expressed in From Wall Street to Main Street, which was the book that, you know, really outlined the idea that investing could be for the masses in the late 1930s. And it's incredible how pervasive it is. And yet at the same time, the public has a huge degree of financial illiteracy. Only a tiny number of people in the United States actually even know what a hedge fund is, even though they have, as an industry, come to dominate the daily trading in the stock market and have almost $4 trillion under management. And in fact, produced most of the money in the last three presidential elections, and actually produced one of the candidates, which was Mitt Romney, who had spent his really most of his career as a private equity fund manager. Private equity and hedge fund are the same organization under the same law. The only difference is that hedge funds are dealing with public wealth, and private equity deal with private wealth, like companies that aren't traded.
And, you know,
so, I mean, yeah, I just, yeah, just want to emphasize this point that nobody, I mean, I did an interview in 2009 with a guy who's a great writer and had been president of the American Society of Business Journalists or Business Columnists, and he didn't know what a hedge fund was.
Yeah, I've got to admit, I have a pretty fuzzy understanding of it. You know, basically, it's a place that won't take my money because I'm not rich enough. It's kind of the limit of my understanding.
Right. Well, you know, the truth is that actually in the 99-member partnership, which is the main form of hedge fund in the United States, actually up to 30 slots go to non-accredited investors who don't have to have any money.
Oh, okay.
If you're a non-accredited investor, which even most people, you know, who work on Wall Street are not familiar with this, you fill out a non-accredited form which asks if you get most of your financial information from A, the radio, B, books, and C, newspapers. So you can tell by that the form hasn't been changed since 1940 when hedge funds were created. Under the Investment Company Act. And so now it has this accredited investor concept. But I have to tell you that, I mean, almost nobody's ever heard of the non-accredited investor. And in fact, I didn't hear it until the lawyers were drawing up the documents for my own fund.
So one of my prejudices about, say, Wall Street as a lever and a representative of capitalism is that capitalism is basically a machine designed to exploit the natural world and turn it into someone's balance sheet. And knowing that you are using the machinery of Wall Street now to represent, you know, against animal cruelty and animal exploitation is, you know, first of all, is there accuracy to that perception, and kind of how do you use the, what do they call it, you know, use the owner's tools to tear down the owner's house?
Yeah, it's a really interesting. I mean, the point of view, I think historically, I would fundamentally agree with. I pretty much totally agree with it. Actually, I do think that's what what happened in the United States with the culture that's been created by the 1940 Investment Company Act. And let me just, before I go more directly to the question, let me make a small point here. Prior to 1940, most of the business taxes in America and most of the assets were owned by corporations who pay income tax or pay tax on their business income. And still today, even in the political discussion, most of the sort of concentration is on the corporate tax rate. But the truth is that the 1940 Investment Company Act transferred a lot of the actual business wealth in the country to the partnership structure, which is what hedge funds and private equity funds are, so that the majority of assets, depending on how you calculate it, are now in the hands of partnerships, almost all of them in the state of Delaware, that, get this, don't pay any tax at all. Partnerships in the United States do not pay tax. They distribute their profits to the partners who, first of all, that's dividing it up by 100, so that if you made $100 million as a partnership, that's not taxed. It's $1 million individually that's taxed by all the partners receiving the benefits, who often can shelter it entirely. So this is one of the biggest changes in taxation. I think it might be the biggest. Well, other than going from tariffs in the late 19th century to the so-called progressive income tax. And I'm mentioning this in relation to your question because what's happened in the last three quarters of a century is that the business structure of the U.S. has become so chaotic, so immune from tax, and so free of regulation that it has allowed an opportunity for progressives to get in the game and to really reverse the traditional orientation of capitalism towards amoral creation of profit regardless of the consequences. And I will give you just an example that is totally known to the public, and it's been on the front page of the New York Times innumerable times, and that is that in the last four congressional cycles, the largest individual donors to political parties in the United States have not. It's not the Koch brothers. It's a hedge fund manager in the Bay Area called Tom Steyer, who is unfortunately not great on animals, although he's a strong environmentalist. And before him, the even more famous George Soros. So the leading sort of 1% contributors in the country right now to politics are actually not on the right, they're on the left. But I would contend that this reality comes out of a far more profound change in the American economy. And why do I say with confidence that nobody knows? Well, first of all, nobody knows about it. Secondly, the 1940 Investment Company Act, which created hedge funds and private equity funds, mandates secrecy. There was no clearinghouse for information. Until 2013, there was no ability to advertise. It's the most secret accumulation of wealth probably in the history of the world. And it's been adopted now. I mean, every country in the world has a, quote, hedge fund culture now, all of which is mimicking the United States. And so it's within that, narrative that I gradually began to see between about 1999 and 2008 that something really dramatic could be done for animals through capitalism. If you want to call this kind of hedge fund management capitalism, I mean, one of our aims is to take down industrial farming, the use the use of the stock market to finance the mass slaughter of animals. And that's an example of the complete evil of capitalism. But in the stock market, as it's developed over the several centuries, really, since the late 1600s, you can make money that way. It's called selling short. And if you read or saw The Big Short, you're familiar with that. And it actually is a very, very effective method to protest companies that are doing evil things. And it's by law secret. So, I have not done anything. I have done some interviews, in general over the years, like the Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg News and so on. But they were just sort of out of my literary interests or because there was a particular reporter that I knew. But there are, huge potential for progressive managers to step in and do stuff that is socially conscious. And I would also point out that environmental companies that do things ranging from, creating greener products to cleaning up the environment are also a $1 trillion industry. Now, they may not be as big as the car makers yet, but they're just as capitalistic. I mean, a company that essentially is trying to, create a meat alternative, Beyond Meat, it's just as much a capitalist enterprise as Tyson Foods. So I think you have this vast, really it's the advent of chaos, I guess, if you look at traditional, traditional finance. But the dramatic change in the corporate / partnership structure of America, I'm just amazed that nobody talks about it. I mean, it didn't come up really in Bernie Sanders' campaign, even though, and I'm not saying this could have been a campaign issue, but, Hillary Clinton's daughter and son-in-law met at a hedge fund. I mean, her son-in-law is a hedge fund manager. I don't believe that Bernie Sanders does not know that hedge funds are dodging far more in taxes than corporations are. But I just think that, the public is so ignorant of the issue that he didn't think he could get anywhere with it. But it's really, when he talked about we were in danger of becoming an oligarchy, I would, my mouth would drop because we've been in an oligarchy really since the 1950s.
So I'm tempted to let this go and let my readers think that I understand more than I do, but my listeners, but I still don't see the connection between this 1940 Private Investment Act and the rise of the hedge funds and the opportunity to kind of undermine the system through progressive investments and shorting evil companies. Can you do a remedial for me?
Yeah. So you probably learned in school, as I did, that in the 1930s, in the wake of the crash, that there were various regulations, like the SEC was created, and that there were, a lot of restrictions on things like margin and selling short and all of this. But the stock market didn't go anywhere in the 1930s. It didn't really rise for that entire decade. And on the eve of World War II, Congress passed legislation which was essentially saying, okay, we give up. Let the really rich come back to the stock market with no regulation at all, no tax on their partnerships, no restrictions on what they do, and no supervision by the SEC. So in 1940, this law was passed. The term hedge fund was coined in 1947 by a writer for Business Week magazine, and that was on the basis that you could sell short as well as buy long.
Okay. So can you explain sell short just briefly?
Right. So selling short selling short is trying to make money on a stock price going down. So basically, you borrow the stock to sell it from a broker, and then when it goes down, if it goes down, you buy it back, and you make the difference between the higher sale price and the lower price you bought it at. It's actually, and I do recommend The Big Short, both film and book. It's really a great, introduction of this whole area to the general public. It's actually more than 10% of the activity in the financial markets every day is selling short. And so that gives you several, to summarize on the point you're bringing up, when you take away regulation, when you take away publicity, when trillions of dollars migrates into this asset class, and nobody knows about it, I mean, in terms of the general political culture, and in fact, the asset class is financing now the majority of presidential candidacies in terms of money. You know, when you accumulate that kind of power, it opens it up to a much broader political spectrum. And New York Magazine did a study, was on the front page of New York Magazine in 2011, where they said that hedge fund managers were the most progressive element in the stock market. And in fact, that 35% of them were Democrats, as opposed to 19% of investment bankers and less than 10% of people working in finance in general. And I won't go into the psychological or cultural reasons for that, but from my experience, it's basically probably true. But when you give them all these tools that did not exist previously, and they feel that there is, whether it's a sector of the stock market that is polluting the economy, polluting the atmosphere, or that's harming animals, or a long list of things, it gives them tools to act against them, which did not previously exist. And also it gives them a degree of political influence that they wouldn't have had otherwise. Just to return to the example of Tom Steyer, I mean, this is a guy who's managing, $20 billion or whatever it is, whose main concern is keeping the country, the water clean and the air clean, and is willing to support candidates who are willing to do that. But he got that money, out of being a hedge fund manager in a way that was not really possible prior to 1940. And I mean, basically, of course, you have the industrial barons like Carnegie and Rockefeller. But for the most part, it wasn't like any old person could set themselves up with a hedge fund and earn that kind of money. And I don't think I mentioned another interesting fact, and that is that other than maybe... I won't even make a metaphor out of it. There are absolutely no legal requirements in the United States to start a hedge fund. You can start a hedge fund on death row. You can start a hedge fund if you're illiterate. I don't think there's any. I was going to make a comparison to the requirements to being president, which are also non-existent. But I think the justification for president, which may be under some question right now, is, well, the people vote, so they'll exclude someone on death row or who is illiterate.
Yeah.
Or we would. That was the thinking. But nobody knows. Hedge funds are started in total secrecy and privacy, so nobody, knows.
So this is a real mind shift for me. Because, having grown up in the world of, say, plant-based nutrition,
mm-hmm.
where the inequalities around funding are very, very clear, where you'll see, you know, the USDA or the Department of Health and Human Services will come out with a, you know, a $3 million Eat Your Veggies campaign over 5 years. And meantime, like one junk food company like M&M Mars or Cadbury Schweppes will spend that much in a day.
Right.
Right. So this huge imbalance exists in my mind around people with money promoting, you know, planet destroying, health destroying profit motive. And you're saying that there's this entire giant, massive black hole of the economy that nobody sees, in which in some cases the reverse is true, that the good guys are spending the money.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I mean, basically, I don't know the clearest way let me say this about how that money is spent and how that money is reported, and that is that all publicly traded corporations in the United States have to issue a quarterly report that has a fair amount of relevant information, including who owns the company and where, how the company's money is spent and so forth. And that's especially true on issues like political contributions and so on and so forth. And of course, we have these decisions, you know, Supreme Court decisions and others, which clearly apply to corporations. They clearly apply to individuals to the extent that they apply rigorously enough, or that they relax regulation. They've been, you know, applauded or criticized, but they the fact is not communicated clearly enough that in the partnership world there are no regulations to do any of these things. I mean, all the financial transactions, the you know, political donations, and a long list of other things are not publicly reported. There are various state laws. I mean, it's a very complicated situation in terms of how LLCs, for example, contribute money. But the truth is that an unregulated and completely secret part of the economy that was legislated into existence in 1940 in an effort to revive the stock market has run out of the barn door and, like, basically run off with, what I would consider in some respects some positive aspects for sure. I don't think strictly from a philosophical point of view that this is a healthy situation at all. But in terms of the ability of progressive causes, they have really, this situation has put the National Democratic Party on a somewhat level playing field with the Republicans. If you look back at the national total spent on presidential campaigns, they don't really start to even out until hedge funds make their big rise to large assets right around the late 90s. And this information, by the way, comes from the candidates have to report on the donations received, but the givers, if they're outside of the corporate structure, it's much easier to give anonymously. And this right now, in terms of speaking practically about animals and in terms of vegan startups, companies that are either trying to find alternative, methods of providing meat-like protein without killing animals, and also the retail end of that, you know, vegan restaurants and distribution. This is the peak in American history for how much money is being raised every year. And that, I think, is information that can be found online. I mean, it's not really exactly what we do, although I serve on a couple of committees of donors and benefactors that review that kind of philanthropic or investment activity. But it is it's sharply rising just in terms of the assets that are now deployed on behalf of animals.
So is there more leverage in kind of using shorts and other tools of the stock market to damage evil companies, or to spend money and place bets on things like Beyond Meat and vegan restaurant chains?
Well, I think if you had comparable amounts of assets right now, which you don't, that there probably could be more leverage actually in using assets or just having general discussions with what I wouldn't hesitate to call evil companies that, you know, would suggest the advantage to them of cutting back on that kind of business or eliminating it. There are far more assets available right now to support vegan startups than there are to short sell these kinds of companies. So that makes probably the strongest momentum on behalf of you know, what would normally be called angel or venture capital investing. However, you know, it depends on really also multiple hedge fund managers getting involved with these kinds of trades, which is something we are working on in terms of developing relationships. And let me also point out that in selling short these companies, they're not only, I mean, they're not really moral trades, because you can make a lot of money short selling most of the major egregious animal stocks in the United States. Their businesses, particularly beef and pork, are under a lot of demographic pressure because meat eating is really declining about 3% every year in the United States. There's a bigger challenge with poultry, and fish is not as concentrated actually in equity situations where they amount to being publicly traded stocks. So I wouldn't say poultry is as low risk or as easy to short, but there are health concerns in terms of, in addition to the moral concerns, and there's also the image concern. So there's a very, very strong financial, you know, bottom line to picking out companies on the basis that they do not have good futures and are not growing their profits, with the, you know, the moral aspect of it being certainly very compelling, but not necessarily being the specific reason for a particular trade.
Mm. So when you talk about companies like Beyond Meat and other meat alternatives or vegan restaurants, I still think of those as serving a kind of upper middle class demographic. Is there a way to use hedge funds to create kind of economic more fairness or equality? And I know that you had a hedge fund or you worked for to create an organization that that supported Native American owned businesses, and I wonder, you know, maybe there's a connection there with my question.
Yeah, well, there is, but it's not necessarily a positive one. I mean, we have created an organization which had trouble getting funding. So although we have used the template in some specific investment situations, it's not an independent fund sort of running under its own momentum, the same way that Green Hills is. Let me also just, again, to make these definitions clearer, hedge funds really invest in publicly traded stocks, you know, companies that are traded on an exchange. And so that's a further remove from, you know, the type of access to, let's say, neglected or groups in society that don't participate in the financial system at all. Then private equity is the type of fund that can buy businesses that are not traded. And then for the smaller businesses, which are the dominant type of business in the Native American communities, then that's really a venture capital, or at a smaller amount of assets, angel capital. So I worked, you know, for years with my partner, Dave Castillo, who is currently the head of a bank in Mesa, Arizona, called Native Capital Access. And it was all about convincing really the tribal financial leaders that doing this type of investing ultimately would work in a way that, you know, basing the economy on government banks, casino income, et cetera, does not work. And, you know, it's been a big challenge. I mean, we have made some inroads with some of the tribes in Arizona, which has Arizona is the largest Native American state in the country. It's, in fact, I mean, the Navajo have almost 50% of the entire American Native American population, and Arizona, one-third of the land, which actually has its own time zone. his native tribes, and you know, we certainly have made some progress, but it's you know, it's kind of the double-edged sword is that there is no, well, there's two, there's no experience with that type of investing, and also that the politics of the tribes, at least in the Southwest, is not as progressive as one might assume from, you know, the historical experience of other really oppressed groups. And that has to do just with a lot of historical affiliations, associations, actually going back originally to the time of Teddy Roosevelt. And that also, you know, is challenging. I mean, it's a very different, you know, cultural and political climate. But we have set up a tribal-based partnership, and you know, we are carrying the message. I can't say that it's really gotten enough of a toehold to really report on results as far as comparing it with. You're right that, I mean, as far as, although the vegan, you know, message up until now has definitely been centered in the middle class, it does have a health aspect to it, which is dramatically important, I think. You know, tribal life expectancy in the United States in the early 50s, and diabetes is totally rampant, for one example. So ultimately, we hope that those tributaries kind of merge, but it hasn't gotten there yet. Mm-hmm.
So when I think about the big picture here, and, you know, before this conversation, I thought that, you know, the big money is, you know, pharmaceutical industry, oil and gas, Monsanto, like they're the ones who always show up contributing to politicians, you know, becoming secretaries of state, things like mm-hmm. that. And now I've learned about this giant black hole of money that's that dwarfs what we see publicly. And now I'm thinking about myself with a limited but existing pool of discretionary income, and other people I know who make more than me or less than me. Is there anything we can do just as consumers or small-time investors or people with 401ks or IRAs to push the things we care about in the world, or should we not even bother?
No, I totally believe in bothering. And just to jump off one company you mentioned, Monsanto, which I would say is, you know, really one of the worst offenders over the last three quarters of a century. It might be the single worst company in terms of the environment and treatment of animals directly and indirectly, that it is worth the time and effort to look at a company like Monsanto or look for a company like Monsanto or a Tyson or a Seaboard Industries, which is the largest transporter of animals to slaughter in the United States.
Say that name again. I kind of cut out for a second.
Seaboard Industries, which is located in Kansas, and which is ticker symbol S as in Sam, E as in Edward, B as in boy. It's a terrible company. I mean, when you look, and all of them try to put a certain percentage of their business in more innocuous, you know, niches. I mean, in the case of Tyson, they actually went so far last fall as to invest $20 million in Beyond Meat, as opposed to, of course, they spend billions of dollars and derive billions of dollars from the slaughter of chickens. But they're all seeing this coming. I mean, the biggest fear that they have is actually that vegan and vegetarian percentages in the population grow with education. They are directly correlated with it, and the company, the country's getting slowly more educated. But anyway, yeah, I think you have to look at what you own. As long as you have access to it, whether it's in a brokerage account, or whether it's in a you know, some type of 401k or IRA, and if there's a financial advisor involved, that they should totally be instructed against certain stocks. It's no mystery what these companies are. I mean, you know, ExxonMobil, probably. I mean, we consider the worst company still to be British Petroleum, based on the Gulf spill and also on the culture that led to the Gulf spill. And British Petroleum has spent billions of dollars in advertising about what a green company they are, when at the time of the deep water spill, it actually occurred because they wanted to get a part that normally costs $90 and they bought it for $10. It's the part, $10, not, you know, $10. It cost them $30 billion, but they saved $80, I believe. And this was the type of, we have an even more famous example of that recently where United Airlines didn't want to pay to send those three employees to Louisville at maybe $100 a ticket on another airline. So instead, they'll spend $20 billion lost revenue and all the other, trademark damage that they're suffering. And this is the way decisions get made. If ordinary people who may not be in the finance world in any way, shape, or form neglect this issue, I mean, they're very easily frightened. And I mean, even better than excluding one of these terrible companies from a stock portfolio is, sending an email to the every company has on their website their vice president for investor relations, which is a euphemism for trying to jack up the stock price. And they run very fast if they think they're getting, sort of spontaneous and unorganized protests, just a person deciding to write and communicate. So I'm a really big believer in that type of activism. Of course, there's also shareholder activism where people introduce resolutions, but they never pass because they can never buy enough stock, to get a 50% vote. But on the ground level of how their public relations work, they're actually pretty, I mean, corporate America is pretty frightened. And by comparison, hedge fund America, if you spent 1,000 years, you couldn't even find where to send an email for almost all the major hedge funds in the country. So they don't really worry too much about that. And I'm not painting them to be a group of angels by any means. I am just saying that they do have a progressive element, which is larger than that in corporate America, and which, unlike corporate America, can absolutely do whatever they want. And since that's a bad situation, I think it's a bad situation, but if you're going to have that situation, how about some good forces using it as a platform to do some good?
Right, as opposed to, we're morally opposed to using swords, so we're going to go out in the battlefield with our bare hands, and the other side has swords.
Right. Yes, exactly. Go ahead. That's a great. You painted a great picture with that. It's totally the truth.
Thanks. So if I see an article in the newspaper or hear something on the radio, so it's better to go to the website and find the email address of the VP of Investor Relations than to just go onto Twitter or Facebook and just rant?
Absolutely. Now, if it's something that can go viral, which I don't really know what the parameters are for gauging, obviously, yes, some of these dramatic, it's not a surprise why the United Airlines, I guess those were originally pictures taken with a phone. I mean, you can understand how that goes viral. But United Airlines, I will say that I had a personal experience with United Airlines where they delayed a flight from San Francisco to Los Angeles by 11 hours, which made it worthless to me, and then did not want to give me my money back. But when I wrote to the vice president of investor relations, I got my money back. Sample of one, and I did. Now that doctor on the flight from Chicago to Louisville had been a stock trader and was yelling that they were going to sell the stock short. I don't know if it would have worked, in terms of the employees he was interacting with, but I will say it might have. This is from my own experience with United Airlines, which was extremely solicitous of my feelings after I wrote and identified myself as a hedge fund manager. I would say that, yes, if more people, that's exactly the place to go, because ultimately the company is worth what its stock price is, and it doesn't have any other value. I mean, supposedly the value of the planes is in the stock price and what's called the book value of the shares. But if you take the shares down to zero, you can boycott United Airlines and nobody can go on their planes. And there's still a United Airlines. But if you take the share price down to zero, there is no longer United Airlines, and they operate on that fear. And, you know, history indicates that they should.
So even if I'm not a hedge fund, should I say I'm a hedge fund manager in the email?
You could probably have more impact, but I mean, you know, that's of course a personal decision.
But I mean, if I don't want to lie, but if I'm not, if I just say
right.
I'm a private citizen and I find this appalling.
Right. I mean, also, the best language to use, which I think is, you know, it may be a little bit challenged, but it's, I think, if you do buy stock or you have any connection to the stock market, to use language to the effect that if you were going to buy the stock, this would be a real big reason not to, I think is, you know, a legitimate thing to say and the one that would make the most impact. Because when you identify yourself as an investor, then you're having thousands of times the impact of identifying yourself as a customer. Hundreds of millions of people fly United Airlines every year, but the core investor group is probably 20,000 people.
Uh-huh.
Now, granted, they own a lot of stock, but you know that would get them an alarm. That would get them alarmed in a hurry.
Right, and I guess a sustained campaign would then tell them this isn't just a normal dip that everyone's going to forget about in 2 days.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I think you know, it's not the only way to do it, but the power of share owners, which in the United States share ownership is among a very broad swath of the population and involves almost all the companies in the S&P 500 has significant shareholdings by various sorts of public entities, not just individuals, but also pension funds that are responsible, like, to the taxpayers of a particular state and all that. It's totally not utilized, and it's actually enormous. I mean, if it were utilized, I do believe there, unfortunately, and you alluded to this earlier, and I mean, it's completely understandable that there is sort of a bit of a cultural disconnect between progressive ideals in America and the history of, in general, the various ways in which business has been anti-progressive, including, you know, suppression of unions and opposition to giving stronger benefits. Although we see how much things have changed, even in the failure to repeal affordable health care in the sort of very formerly kind of right-wing reactionary organizations in the healthcare field who opposed, you know, the Republican bill, you know, shows that some of these fault lines are really shifting in terms of, you know, what the history has been. I'm old enough to remember the AMA opposing Medicare in the 1960s, but the AMA strongly supported keeping the government sponsorship of healthcare in this situation, and there's a whole, you know, intersect with the pharmaceutical companies, which are also in certain areas of their business have horrible ethical practices, but which, you know, would formally have lined up with private medical and economic interests, but were very sensitive to the fact that most of the country did not want to do the repeal.
Right.
And that can filter into their shareholders. Yeah.
Yeah. Before I let you go, you know, just one thought that crops up when you describe, you know, we originally started talking about, you know, factory farming and the incredible cruelty that goes on there. And we kind of ended with this United Airlines flight. And the difference is, of course, that animals don't have cell phones, and so they can't take pictures of what happens every day. Is there more incentive than ever because of all this PR and viral stuff for companies to pass things like these ag gag laws so that we can't look in, because there aren't slaughterhouses with glass walls, and there's less and less we can do to know the truth? Or are things, you know, getting better there, or can we fight against that kind of obfuscation?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, there is an unprecedented push for this type of repressive legislation, beginning with the Animal Terrorism Act about 15 years ago, which actually, it has been used to try to intimidate various ways of opposing, slaughterhouse enterprises. It is a major problem for the Animal Terrorism Act, going up against the hedge fund industry with all of its incredible legal... I mean, the hedge fund industry really is the most protected business enterprise in the history of the United States, and there is nothing close to it in terms of what it's exempt from. And for that reason, I think that some of these other, the opposition, trying to criminalize in terms of free speech, all kinds of exposure of slaughterhouses is a very high priority now for the, for all of the companies that are involved in this industry. And I think, again, the best response, since you can find all the video that you'll ever need, even, in trailer clips from some of the movies that have been made, like The Ghost in Our Machine and The Last Pig, which is coming out soon, and a lot of these films show you what you need to know, is to try to bring to bear your individual investment and consumer power against companies that participate in this business. There is no publicly traded corporation in the United States that is entirely 100% in the animal slaughter business, and they're all not in it to that percent for the same reason, and that is the growing wave of consciousness. So, it may be frustrating from day to day, and of course in some states, there is some success with this type of legislation. But I do think that, California, which has at least made some efforts on behalf of poultry, and some of the other states, Michigan also, they're major states, and ultimately raising public awareness. Nobody in America would eat these foods if they had specific knowledge of where they came from. Maybe I'm too optimistic, but it certainly would drastically reduce. What I like to tell people is the tuna boycott in the late 1980s on the issue of catching dolphins in the nets achieved 70% in the supermarket, and they solved that net issue in a real, to the extent it's been solved, but they at least made a pretense of doing it, within weeks. And you can get that kind of grand dolphins have been selected as an acceptable animal for caring about. But, to me, this is all the culture and the what people are exposed to. So if just working with the access that exists now, even without glass walls, I think raising people's consciousness about these issues, which I understand from Gene you're doing a great job on, is really going to matter.
Right on. Well, you've given me some really useful new insights and marching orders around tools that I was unaware of. So I'm really grateful to you for your insights in this hidden world and your willingness to share them with the rest of us.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity. I say something now and then, and I did actually write a blog piece for Wall Street Journal Reporter in September of 2013, where I laid all this out. But, and that has to do with the issue of what is the line right now actually between the banks of the United States and the hedge fund industry, which owns, it would come as a surprise to many, 18% of the assets of the banking industry in America are owned by hedge funds. An interesting development, it was zero before the 2008 crash. So when you look at the Dodd-Frank and all the regulation, yes, they regulated certain aspects of the banking industry. And at the same time, there were no prohibition against totally unregulated hedge funds buying the banks. So we have had a significant net reduction in regulation for that reason since 2008. For just one example of how the nicest word you could use really is strange, the global financial system has really become. But it's not strange if your idea about capitalism is the accumulating the largest amount of money for the smallest number of people, which I totally agree with Sanders on, and which doesn't lead to good moral results, and, you know, which is why the hedge fund industry has been helped by its secrecy to be where it is, because if there's nobody who knows what's going on, then nothing's going to change.
Right. I just received in the mail today a book that I ordered after reading a couple of reviews. It's called Donut Economics by Kate Raworth.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've, if you've seen that.
I have. I actually read a review, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's... yeah, well, I won't speak to the book. I haven't read it, but I think any summary of you know, sort of the broader issues and the broader structures of the not only the American economy but the world economy, especially you know, with the fall of with the end of the Cold War, or at least the fall of total state communism in these other major countries, you know, it's all been an imitation of the American way of doing business. The United States, also another point here, the United States, which is 3% of the world's population, has, well, it's 35% if you looked it up from a UN statistical basis, 35% of the world's GDP. And although they don't keep records on this, but anecdotally and in many other ways, I believe the United States actually has, at 3% of the population, really more than half of the wealth in the world. I don't think it's a secret. But I think you need to look at that number right next to, you know, the 1% and all these other statistics that are around here, because the effect of that, maybe in the 19th or early 20th century, it would have been some sort of, you know, global, like, bump for Marxism, but the effect of it right now, and I think we saw this in the presidential election, is not progressive thinking, it's, well, how do we get that kind of wealth? And you see this in every country in the world, except for maybe North Korea. So, you know, and that delivery mechanism, and this is all available online, is really what's called shadow banking, a term that I think Hillary Clinton did mention once in the Democratic primary process, and Bernie Sanders not at all. And shadow banking is essentially hedge funds.
Mm-hmm.
By the last estimate that I've been able to find, it was in 2012, the World Economic Forum, which is a Swiss organization, said that the shadow banking system had $67 trillion in it. By comparison, that's about twice the size of the U.S. stock market, and that's totally unregulated banking money. And that's, you know, we're just trying to carve out a really tiny niche for on behalf of the animals here. But the truth is that any niche, when you're talking about that kind of, you know, untapped potential, it can really matter. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist at all, but I stumbled into this world really in the late 90s through my own sort of just stock market interests. And I've been pretty amazed at what I've found.
Right. Well, it's a funny word, you know, funny concept of conspiracy theorist, which is often used by people to make people who see the truth doubt themselves and make other people doubt them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not a conspiracy if it's systematic and it's happening.
And there is absolutely, I mean, again, you know, people can always say the earth is flat or whatever, but there is an enormous wealth of material online, actually, if you look for just if you just type in secrecy of hedge funds. I mean, this is all publicly available. And there's a very simple explanation for the silence on this as sort of a political issue, and that is, where are the campaign contributions coming from? And by the way, who owns the media outlets? I mean, the New York Times exists right now on a long-term loan from Carlos Slim, who is predominantly a Mexican hedge fund manager, although he's been accused of being many other things. And unfortunately, you know, even if you look at the networks, there are all kinds of just amazing interconnections. And I don't think that it even has to be. I have had personal experience with this. I mean, you know, I had personal experience. I did write an op-ed piece in 2009 because Henry Paulson, who was, you know, Treasury Secretary during that crisis under Bush, had been CEO of Goldman Sachs, and I had a 2005 letter from Henry Paulson. We were Goldman Sachs clients, and he basically had written a letter saying that we were not borrowing enough money to really, you know, remain with the firm in terms of how actively we were trading. It was a routine letter. I mean, there was nothing personal about it, but it did highlight that the idea of using more leverage and borrowing more money was part of Henry Paulson's, you know, leadership Goldman Sachs, who 3 years later had gone before the Senate Banking Committee and condemned, you know, the banks themselves for loaning too much money. And I proposed that of the five leading, I would say the five leading newspapers in the country, I did get interest from the LA Times. But at the end of that process, they wanted me to change the op-ed so it didn't identify a particular firm. Hmm. And, you know, the whole point of it to me was not only identifying the firm, but that I had some letter. So that sort of told me something way back when. And, you know, but I'm mainly concerned. I want to emphasize, of course, all this is relevant. Really, I can't control that there's no social scrutiny of the way the country's organized. It's maybe not a big surprise that a group gets enough money that they can exert a lot of influence, but it's a real opportunity for you know, exerting influence on behalf of humane treatment of animals.
Right. Well, that's my head is spinning. I need to spend a lot of time thinking about all the implications of this, you know, for my own life. But the takeaway is that as a potential investor, I have a lot of power in writing, and that mm-hmm. you know what I think I see in the world is probably a sliver of what's actually going on behind the scenes. And so I'm very grateful to you for being in that world and being willing to come out swinging, naming names, and holding people accountable for their positions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so you know, I feel like somebody should say something.
Yeah.
I say that. I mean, many people do much more committed and much more risky things than I do, but to my knowledge, I'm the only hedge fund manager interested in the issue, the only one who said anything. There's only about 7,000 managers in the country, which is like, I think, 12. There's 12 managers for every congressman, I think. It's something like that. And, you know, you can extend that to maybe there's 12 managers supporting every congressman financially. It's pretty much what the system is now, so...
Right.
It can't stay secret forever, but I think it'll take a much bigger crash than 2008 to really develop the storyline for the public.
Right. So if people want to follow your writing, is there a website or a compendium of the articles you write?
Yeah, we are actually looking at a website right now. Traditionally, hedge funds haven't had them in terms of the secrecy culture. They did pass a law in 2013 legalizing advertising, but what I'm looking at right now, developing a website that actually would have a lot of Green Hills connectivity on it, and then you know, would be more broadly themed to animals. But other than that, I mean, you know, and I apologize for Google being kind of rudimentary, but also people can contact me at oceanequity@earthlink.net, and I actually read my emails and reply to them if they're interested in any aspect of the story.
Oceanequity@earthlink.net, and I'll also put that in the show notes for today's episode.
Okay.
Cool.
Okay,
that's
good.
Thank you. That's very generous of you. I'm sure you'll get some very interesting commentary.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lee Slonimsky, thank you so much. This has been so enlightening, and it, as I said several times, this has made me think about the worlds of finance and progressive action in a whole new way, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that, and I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to talk about it, and, you know, let's hope that, you know, one of the solutions to the history of capitalism is to change the future with it.
Right on. All right, take care.
All right, Howard, take care. Okay.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Plant Yourself podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Big Change Program led by me and Josh Lajani, which is starting up again in June 2017, visit bigchangeprogram.com. And be sure to check out the show notes for today's episode with links to all of Lee's works at plantyourself.com/211. 211 episodes. Woo! If you're new to the show, you can catch up on 210 archived episodes over at plantyourself.com. And if you get the podcast, but not my weekly newsletter, The Big Change Bulldog, you can sign up and get the No Recipe Required cheat sheet at plantyourself.com/cheat. And big thanks to Plant Yourself podcast patrons: Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Anthony Disson, Brittany Porter, Dominic Marrow, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Alan Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Christine Nielsen, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Vilkanovsky, David Bizek, The Mysterious, Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Victoria Dolomanova, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Andrew, Josina, Julianne Roland, Stu Dolnick, Sarah Durkas, Rhymes with Circus, Kelly Cameron, Wayne Pedersen, Leanne Peterson, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Fronzak, Gina, Jeanette Benham, and Gila Lassert. Well, you heard me take a little breath in the middle there anyway, so I guess I was cheating, for your generous support of the podcast. And thanks also to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Don, Dance of Peace. You can find more of his music at willridenour.com. If you would like to support this show and my efforts to bring this message to a wider and wider audience, you can share this and other episodes on social media and via email. You can write a review on iTunes. Here's a couple of reviews that came in beginning in May. Fantastic! Exclamation point times three says Forever a Student 1111. He says, or she says, this is an outstanding podcast in a league of its own. Best host, superb content and delivery with a wealth of information. This has enhanced my human experience. Howard, you are an inspiration. Keep up the good work. Wow, thank you so much, Forever Student 1111. And writing about the PYP 208, Chris Voss, the interview on negotiating with others and ourselves, Willboy51 writes, Howard Jacobson's Plant Yourself podcast is one of my favorites. The primary focus at the beginning was health and nutrition, and it seems to have grown to encompass a variety of living skills. Howard is a great listener, and he is always sincerely into the people he interviews. The interview with Chris Voss is one of his best. I've listened twice and plan to read Voss's book. Wow, thank you, Willboy51. I love Chris Voss and his work. And yeah, I am totally into the people I interview, because a couple times I wasn't, and I never published them, and I just determined, like, why would I spend an hour talking to people that I wasn't into, you know, if I didn't absolutely have to. So good noticing there. And yeah, the podcast is definitely growing and changing, and I'm growing and changing. So it's really, really fun. In garden news, things are coming along apace. Yesterday, we planted some rainbow popcorn. So that's going to be fun to see it come up and grow. The beans are doing pretty good. This week, my main backbreaking task is to haul wood chips to all the garden paths and make them nice again. And I'm doing that while listening to, first of all, a Rich Roll podcast interview with J.D. Roth, who is the creator of The Biggest Loser and a couple of other weight loss shows on TV. And then J.D. Roth's excellent book, The Big Fat Truth, which I'm listening to on Audible. And I agree with about 90% of it. And I'm finding it very inspiring and getting lots of ideas for how we can make the Big Change Program and how I can make my own coaching better. In running news, by the time you hear this, I will have run the Umstead Half Marathon and hopefully will have done well enough to begin to recover and turn my attention to Leadville, which is coming up in less than a month. If you want to follow me on Strava, you can get all the gory details of my workouts and my races. Well, that's it for this week. As always, be well, my friends. Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize, all the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.